Choke points.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Acton's Quality Roofing. It wouldn't be a Seahawks Sunday without some sort of traffic challenge. So Chris is here to tell us what's going to be happening westbound on I-90.
Yeah, this is going to be more than just your typical challenge getting to a Seahawk game. I-90, as you know, the primary route into Lumen Field from the east side. It's a direct shot right there into the stadium district. But it's not going to be an option for you guys getting to the Hawks game on Sunday or across Lake Washington all weekend long. An expansion joint across the westbound lanes needs to be replaced. It was replaced on the on-ramp from West Mercer Way last weekend. That was the slowing we had on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Now it's time to do the main line.
We're going to start some work on the 22nd, and then that's going to carry all the way through the Monday morning, the 26th, where we're going to replace the expansion joint that goes across the mainline lanes. That's going to mean that westbound I-90, we're going to have a full closure there.
That means, again, full closure, westbound I-90. Stop. No more.
Can't you get on from the ramp that was fixed?
We'll get to that in a minute because I really we've got some words to talk about there. But yes, the answer is yes to that. Either way, the Department of Transportation's Tom Pierce says you should avoid westbound 90 if you can.
People are not going to be able to get through. They'll be able to get onto Mercer Island, but they will not be able to continue through.
East side drivers know their options, and they aren't great. One of them includes a toll.
People on the east side, if they want to get to the west side of Lake Washington, they're pretty much going to have to use 405 to get around the lake, or they can use 520. Of course, there is a toll there.
The daytime tolls on 520 on the weekend range from $1.40 to $2.65. If you have a good-to-go account, $2 more if you pay by mail. This will also put a lot more people onto I-5, which will make it slower than normal, too.
The Seahawks do have a 125 game on Sunday, the 25th. So, again, Hawks fans, plan ahead. You can still get there. You're just going to have to plan ahead to get around.
It's usually about 8 miles from the I-90 405 interchange in Bellevue over to Lumen Field. If you're going to go south into Renton, that trip would be about 22 miles. If you go across 520 to the north, you have a toll and about a 15-mile trip. My best advice for all weekend is to go early or go late. Now, Dave, as you mentioned, Mercer Island residents will still be able to go west across the lake by using that West Mercer Way on-ramp, which they fixed last weekend. It will be open. And I know what drivers are thinking. I'll just jump off I-90 somewhere in the middle of Mercer Island, jam the neighborhood streets all the way to that ramp using Waze or whatever I can to just kind of go on my own way. Please don't do that. The roads cannot handle much extra traffic, if any, Dave, as you know.
Yes.
And, of course, you've been telling me that there's a construction project on 40th there on Mercer Island that might get in your way as well. Yeah. Just remember, be courteous and find a detour that works for you, but don't jam the neighborhoods in Mercer Island. I know you can get through, but you'll probably lose just as much time trying to work your way through that backup and then onto that ramp as you would just going around from the get-go.
This is one of those reasons where I need a friend with a boat.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is going to be a big problem.
Let's talk West Seattle Bridge, which has reopened after 2.5 years of detours, and local businesses are hoping that means a mass return of customers. Car News Radio's Sam Campbell was in West Seattle and spoke with community members and business owners.
Civil engineers wrote a prescription of decongestant for West Seattle streets with the bridges reopening. Roads around the West End, easy, smooth, and steady with an otherwise unremarkable number of drivers. Harbor Avenue now in recovery, no longer dry heaving sedans into fractured detours. Commute times have been slashed, and West Seattle is reunited with the city. Some who live in the area, though, cautious and pleasantly surprised of the once-cracked bridge's return, now back from emergency repairs.
Oh, it's sort of surreal. It kind of seemed like waiting for a check in the mail that's never going to come or something.
But a consensus, driving to and from West Seattle is not an all-day commitment anymore.
It felt like a whole journey and just this complete arduous trek.
The closure deterred visitors not only from Magnolia, Columbia City, and even Capitol Hill, but locals say the clogged streets forced them to nix trips farther than a couple miles from home. Two sisters eating at the Chelan Cafe under the bridge tell me they're excited for what the reopening means for their decades-old neighborhood staple and other small businesses in the area.
It'll make it easier for people to get here.
Small businesses have been really, really compromised by the closure. So now it'll bring a lot of business back to them, those that survived it.
Philip Sidori signed the papers to open The Spot in West Seattle in February 2020. His dream of an espresso bar hangout live music restaurant became a reality 2 weeks before COVID overwhelmed the city.
Then the bridge went down. Yeah, it was like lockdown and then the bridge went down. So that's really, the bridge has been had a huge impact, not just for us and my little place here, but for West Seattle as a whole.
He credited support from the community for its survival. Being cut off from the rest of the city, Sidori says staffing, though, was made even harder.
People that didn't live in West Seattle didn't want to even commute 2 miles because they would have to sit in two hours of traffic both ways to work in our community.
Now with that crosstown vein resurrected, he's hoping it pumps much-needed lifeblood into small businesses like his. Whitney Moore with the West Seattle Chamber of Commerce tells me he's not alone. She says although it's hard to parse which lost revenue came from the pandemic or the bridge, the reopening has got many looking forward. Sam Campbell, Cairo News Radio.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And now joining us from the Detroit Auto Show, now improved and in person, here's Jeff Gilbert from the Car Chronicles. I want to ask you about the various startups that you saw there, including one car called Y-tricity, which would be able to charge itself wirelessly.
Well, that is interesting because that's kind of a cool thing that they're doing here in the Detroit area. They're setting up an experimental highway which has the ability to, you know, how you can now wirelessly charge your phone.
Right.
It has the ability to do that on a larger scale to vehicles. So theoretically, the idea is someday we might be able to take electric vehicles down the road and charge them as we're driving, if we set the roadways up to do that. Of course, here in Michigan, we have enough trouble fixing the potholes, but it is an interesting experiment, and it's one of the cool things you think of when you're thinking about electric vehicles.
I see. So this would mean like planting induction coils in the roadways
like
or something like that?
Infrastructure, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. So again, the idea right now is to experiment with it and even see if it works in a situation like that. That's how early we are into things like this. There are situations, systems like that, that you could theoretically do in a garage. But seeing that nobody has put them on the market, that tells me that the demonstrations I've seen are extremely expensive and probably are not yet, you know, ready for consumers. But again, it's interesting to see what we can experiment with. Some of this stuff is going to work. Some of this stuff isn't. But it's fascinating to watch.
And how was the news met President Biden's announcement that he's spending millions to put chargers all over the United States? Was that cheered? Was that premature? What was the reaction?
Well, a couple of interesting things. It was kind of, if I can be honest with you, kind of reacted with a yawn, because this is a subset of the infrastructure bill that passed that has billions of dollars for EV infrastructure. So what the president announced is just a small part of that. But what is interesting is to see the strategy that is going out there to try to get these chargers, A, in underserved places, because, you know, a company wants to make a profit on it. But you know, we need EV chargers in neighborhoods where maybe they won't be profitable. So that's where the government's helping. Also to make sure we can refuel on the road. We're seeing that from the government, but we're also seeing it from the private sector. GM, I think this is the coolest thing I've seen with EV charging. GM has teamed up with Pilot, that owns Pilot and Flying J truck stops. Those are going to have EV fast chargers. And to me, it's great to have a place where you can go and do something while your vehicle's charging.
That's still, to me, the main problem with electric vehicles. No, there's no question about the power and the versatility and the sophistication, but people don't want to run out of power, and there's still no way to charge one up as fast as you can fill a tank of gas.
Exactly, and I'll make it personal, because I get to drive a lot of EVs, and I can't wait to drive one because they are a blast to drive. They're cool. You feel like you are the most high-tech person on the planet. But would I buy one? No, and that's probably because of that reason, because that's an issue with my life. I drive a lot, and that's a problem. You can fill something to 80% in about a half an hour with a fast charger. That's a lot better than before, but it's still not like 10 minutes in filling a gas tank. But I will add, there are a lot of smart people working on the problem.
Are there any automakers who are like, staunch, we're going to burn gas for the rest of our existence? Anybody resisting the EV creep?
Yeah, but they're not quite like, you know, you will take my V8 out of my cold, dead hands. But there is a big disagreement between car makers on EVs. GM and Volkswagen are the all-in people. It's like, this is where we're headed. You know, watch out. On the other hand, you've got Toyota, of all people, who gave us the Prius and will, by the way, will be giving us a new Prius later this year, who have spent a lot of money on hybrids. And they're saying, hey, wait a minute, this technology is cheaper. It's proven. It's going to work. You know, we're going to have gasoline powered vehicles for years to come. We'll just hybridize them more. And with higher fuel economy rules, things of that nature, just about every vehicle that's gasoline is going to have some kind of hybridization in the coming years. And for Toyota, they probably have the best hybrid technology out there. So they're heavy into that. And it's interesting to see that Toyota did get an exception in California's EV requirements, where if you have a plug-in hybrid that gives you at least 50 miles of range, you can still sell it. So even under California's strict new rules, gasoline engines will be permitted if the vehicle can go at least 50 miles in electric mode.
Jeff Gilbert from the Car Chronicles, WWJ in Detroit. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
King County Executive Dow Constantine is out with a spending plan for public safety. The report from Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott.
Our communities need and expect and indeed deserve to have genuine and just safety.
Some $75 million across nearly a half dozen departments, all coordinating efforts to address everything from behavioral health needs, traditional public safety, staffing needs, gun violence, and keeping young people out of lockup.
We have to come at this from many different angles if we're going to achieve genuine community safety.
King County Executive Dow Constantine announcing his proposal yesterday that focuses on four main themes, including deploying a highly trained and coordinated safety network by filling 200 key county vacancies, ensuring safe and appropriate places for those in crisis by expanding behavioral health and restoring jail services, and identifying youth detention replacement programs, being data-informed and responsive to community needs by prioritizing diversion and intervention programs, and providing accountability and victim support.
We are deploying options to keep residents safe.
Among other things, his proposal would spend nearly $2.5 million to fund what's known as the VITAL program, expanding it to 80 individuals who are frequent flyers of the jail system or repeat offenders to address their underlying housing, health, and other basic needs, which evidence shows, according to Constantine, disrupts their cycle of crime. Over $7 million would provide community-based accountability and services to more than 800 young people who've committed nonviolent crimes through restorative community pathways. Another $2 million would fund record expungement and legal financial obligation relief related to vacated marijuana convictions. Another $2 million or so for launching four new co-responder units so behavioral health professionals can address crises along with law enforcement. There'd also be $20 million to support adding 140 more Metro Transit security officers. There's also more than $22 million to continue addressing the felony court case backlog that grew exponentially during the pandemic. Constantine was also asked about pandemic-era jail booking restrictions.
But as soon as we have the opportunity to do so, we will, of course, relax the remaining restrictions on booking, which are not particularly significant.
But pressed on the issue that many in law enforcement say is significant.
Every jurisdiction, every police department has throughout had the ability to call up the jail and say, we have a guy whose current offense doesn't fit the criteria for booking, but he is someone who's causing an ongoing challenge in our community, and we want to come book him.
So there are still restrictions on the COVID restrictions on the jails?
Yes. It's up to Dale Constantine to lift those. He's been, I had looked into that before, and they were still in place. But as he said, he doesn't feel like the ones that are there right now are significant. And as soon as they can, they'll lift those.
Well, as soon as they can, what does that mean? I mean, I'm
nothing more specific than that, unfortunately.
Okay, so
I want to point out I didn't get it in the recorded part, but there's also $5 million for the King County Sheriff's Department to finally outfit all of its deputies with body cameras, which they don't have. They are one of the only departments in the Puget Sound area that don't have them. And it would be a slow rollout, Patty Coltendale, our new sheriff, said yesterday. It would be the end of 2025 if this funding is approved, that they expect to have that fully up and running.
And why is that taking so long?
You know, she was asked that yesterday, and she said, that's a great question. And remember, she's only been in office not even a full year. Mm-hmm. But she said, you know, there are other sheriffs have tried. Part of the issue is that there's a contract that's currently being bargained for the sheriff's deputies, and these are cameras have to be bargained. Specifically, I think the issue that one of the heads of the union said they were kind of a sticking point on is whether or not officers involved in a use of force shooting would have the ability to review their body camera before putting their full statement forward. So that seems to be somewhat of a sticking point. But there is an appetite by the deputies, they say, for these cameras to be able to wear them. So it doesn't sound like it'll be a huge problem. It'll take some time. The other issue is that the servers for storing all of the data has to be created. They don't have that yet. So that's where most of the cost comes from.
Okay, well, better late than never. Back to the jail and the frequent flyers. Is there still... I mean, I think we've learned that the softer, gentler approach to frequent flyers hasn't worked, right?
And, you know, you would think so, but no, that's not necessarily what the direction of this proposal is. He's talking about spending more on the VITAL program to expand that to 80 individuals. These are heavy repeat offenders, but it's about addressing their needs, right? Making sure they have the housing and the health care needs that they have. That could be behavioral health care, whatever it might be. And that's a smaller program, right? We're only talking about, I think it maybe currently serves 40 to 50. They're expanding it to 80. So that would be not a huge part of the population. I think they say 100 or so repeat offenders are the ones that cause the most damage, though. But again, that is addressing their needs, not so much throwing the book at them, if you will.
Well, I mean, it's not throwing the book is such an ugly term. How about just a timeout? You know, like you send the kid up to the room for a few hours. There are some people who need a timeout while they either make the decision to get help or, you know, beds open up so they can get help. But the primary responsibility has to be public safety here, right?
It does have to be public safety. But again, I think specifically with this particular program, we're talking about those who are time out and them just kind of being on their own trying to figure it out. It's not going to help them. They need that extra help, somebody to walk them through that wraparound services and all of that. Right. Again, that's 80 individuals. There's also, though, 5.1 million, I think, for a new program. This is called Metro Safe Reform Initiatives. It's basically a human services thing where they're going to connect people in crisis on or near Metro Transit with some resources and services. Again, we're focusing heavily on that. There's not a lot in here that is focused heavily on locking people up. The only sign of that is that there is funding to make sure that you hire 100 more corrections officers, because remember, the jail is very understaffed right now, as well as 70 more sheriff's patrol deputies, because they are coming up short as well.
Again, locking people up, an ugly term. I prefer timeout.
Timeout. Okay. Timeouts. You're right.
Okay.
But there you go.
Okay. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
I know so much more about you today. Time for your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Baird, focused on your financial needs since 1919. Visit BairdSeattle.com. In Katy, Texas, 22-year-old Jalen Gray dreamed of being a park ranger, but he had to give that up when his mother died, and he had to care for his 12-year-old brother, Julian. CBS's Steve Hartman picks up the story from here.
It's not really a good feeling giving up at all, but
sometimes it's not quitting, it's just doing the right thing.
Yeah, I had to do what I had to do, so...
Today, Jalen's sole priority is his 12-year-old brother, Julian.
He's my reason.
All right, let's go.
His reason and his responsibility. Their mother and only parent died 2 years ago.
I just miss her so much.
From that day on, I swore, you know, at all costs, I'm protecting them.
And then things got worse.
Yeah, I was basically defeated. I had nowhere to go.
Life went from bad to unbearable after that big freeze hit Texas last year. The pipes burst in their house, the one their mother left them, and ruined everything.
Some strange times.
Then a contractor Jalen hired to fix it took their life savings and ran off.
Tragic, isn't it?
The boys were pretty much homeless, living with their last surviving close relative, when a nonprofit called Katie Responds caught wind. The group fixes up houses after natural disasters. Over the years, they've helped more than 100 families, but few more worthy than those boys.
Yeah, it breaks your heart.
Had to help.
Had to.
Executive Director Ron Peters.
They had no idea people would want to jump in and help them.
Which may explain their jaw-dropping, literally speechless reactions.
I was overwhelmed.
Thanks to an army of donors and volunteers, the brothers are finally and forever back in their mother's house. Fully renovated, better than ever. And although no builder could ever patch the hole in their hearts, Katie Responds did the next best thing.
There's just so many nice people in this room right now, and it makes me so happy.
When their mother died, Julian and Jalen thought all they had was each other, but they were off by one whole community.
7:49, Seattle's Morning News, and now, after making it through the epic backup this morning, here he is, G. Scott. So what are you upset about now?
He's upset at you.
I'm upset at you about ants, but we'll get to that last.
Okay, fine.
I'm upset at anyone who gets mad at those who have the opportunity to do their jobs and work from home. If you, any of my brothers and sisters out there, were on I-5 and you probably were hearing the traffic report from Sully, you know what we just went through out there. It was rough. It was really bad. And so I was thinking as I was driving, I'm like, first of all, I'm starting to get mad, which, wow, who wants to start off their day mad? So then let's say you get through all that traffic, right? And some of you guys are really good at it, but some of us, like me, you're probably not that good at it. You've gone through all of this traffic, right? You're trying not to speed. You're trying not to jump in a carpool lane. You're trying not to get road rage. You're trying to keep contained and keep your cool, but it's going to take you 2 hours to get to work. And then you get to work, and then you're supposed to be this happy-go-lucky coworker,
and not
right?
Exhausted.
Right? You're yeah. supposed to be on top of your game. You're supposed to execute everything according to plan. But people fail to realize you just spent 2 hours of misery right there. Mm. So my point is that I'm coming in with this. Let's go with the new normal, baby. If you are able to work from home, then work from home. You know what? It really does make the roads better. I just came in this morning. I barely made it to get on your show. And then I'm getting ready to park my car. I'm minding my own business. You guys bring up the story about ants. I was super excited. Come to find out that there is 2.5 million ants for every one person because there's 20 quadrillion ants in the world. As a little child, I love ants.
Yeah, they're good.
And then the nicest man, who I thought was the nicest man on the planet, the person that I called the Godfather, had the audacity to get mad and be bothered by ants.
I thought it was terrifying, yes. Because it shows that they can take over the earth at any time.
Yeah.
So let me guess, you're afraid the ants are coming for your jobs too?
Not my jobs, though. They're going to eat my house.
Yeah, the carpenter ones.
Yeah, the carpenter ants are going to eat my, they've already started eating my wood pile. Mm-hmm. They're going to eat my house.
Well, ants got to eat, Dave.
I'm happy with them eating, there's a whole big world out there.
It's their wood to begin with.
Oh, so not in your backyard.
Yeah, exactly. No ants in my backyard. Yes, you got that right.
Dave's an ant NIMBY.
I mean,
now, for people who want ants in their backyard, I say, you know, you're free to do it, but just make sure there's a fence between your ants and my yard.
Oh, you want a fence?
I want a fence.
Not a wall, right. But a fence.
No, not a wall.
All right.
Just a fence. An insect fence. So it can be very short.
Are ants allowed in Mercer Island?
Well, technically speaking, no, but they do make it on somehow. I'm not sure how they figured out how to get on the bridge.
No, you've heard
especially
how they
all
survive
the construction.
Floods. They all band together and create an ant island, and then they just float until they find
land
again.
I admire their social organization. That's part of what makes them terrifying. They can think.
So you don't love ants the way I do.
You love them.
I'm finding them.
Did you have like a little ant farm as a kid?
Yes.
Well, that's why.
Yes, I just told Chef and Ursula this morning as we're preparing the show. It's actually going to be something we were talking about at 9:47. Yes, mm-hmm. As a child, I've always had this huge fascination with ants. As a matter of fact, between us right now, mm-hmm. ants were my first friends before I had friends in the neighborhood.
Cutie.
No, I'm being very sweet. Serious. I used to be out there on the grounds watching them. And so I would get, like, when I did start to get friends in the neighborhood, if I would see the kids try to step on the ants, I did not like that.
I would never step on an ant. I used to watch them carrying heavy stuff. I said, you know, it inspired me to work out more. Yeah. But I don't want them in the kitchen.
They're brutal, though. If somebody's, like, holding them back, they'll throw them off
right.
the edge.
What
of
was your
lip.
Comment you said to me before we got on there?
Oh, I said, well, look how powerful you can become when you follow a matriarch, a queen, right?
That was good.
Thank you. Follow
G.
the
Scott
ants.
With Ursula. And on Tuesdays, we go live to Washington, D.C., and New York Times investigative reporter David Farenthold. Let me bring up a story that we've completely neglected, the Brett Favre controversy. Your beat is now nonprofit accountability, and Brett Favre's nonprofit is accused of, the headline I saw said that he took welfare money, which seems crazy. So what can you tell us about this?
Well, this is an incredible story uncovered by a journalist at this organization called Mississippi Today. Basically, the state of Mississippi had a whole bunch of welfare money, money meant for needy families. And it gave the money to Brett Favre, some for speeches that he gave. And it also funneled a huge amount of the money to Brett Favre's pet project, which was building a volleyball stadium, a stadium just for volleyball at the University of Southern Mississippi, where his daughter played volleyball. So this has come out now through reporting, public records, and a new lawsuit among some of the folks involved in this, where there's even been texts like from Brett Favre where he's like, are you sure no one's going to find out about this? And is assured that no one will. It had the cooperation, apparently, of a guy named Phil Bryant, who was the governor of Mississippi until a couple years ago. It seems like it goes really high, and it's a pretty – I mean, if all these reports are true, it's a pretty pure diversion of money meant to help people for a pet project of a famous person.
Why would he – I mean, he's rich, isn't he? I mean, fairly well off. Why would he need to use –
I see all those ads for him selling, you know, copper pants, you know, pants where they put copper in them.
Really?
You think he would have the money to do this himself. He has a lot of endorsements. But I guess why not – why – yeah, there was – just to give you a sense of how he viewed this. There was one text in which Favre got some of this money from the state and said in the text, like, Santa came today or something like that. Like, made a reference to Santa Claus.
Huh. But the volleyball stadium was built and it's functional and people are playing volleyball in it?
Yes. It doesn't seem to be helping the people of Mississippi who need welfare other than to provide them some entertainment if they like volleyball.
Well, yeah, exactly. The New York Times, your paper, has a piece this morning about voting machine tampering in Georgia after the 2020 presidential vote. And this involved one of the rump electors, the phony electors, who had access to the voting equipment. How did that happen?
There was a county in Georgia, Coffee County, where they voted overwhelmingly for Trump. But the people in that county, after Trump lost Georgia, there was an effort by the folks in that county to try to help this, you know, the effort of Trump's folks to overturn the election. So what's new today, there's been some great reporting by my old paper, The Washington Post, and my new paper, The New York Times, about how the folks working for Trump trying to overturn the election got access to voting machines. Local Republican officials who had said that they either weren't there or just stopped in for a minute turned out that they were there for a long time. They were part of this. This could be important if there is ever a legal case brought against these folks for tampering with elections. That's not something the public is supposed to do, to just get access to the machines that count the votes.
But these are the people who supposedly are trying to make sure that there's integrity in the voting system, and they just had free access to the voting machines?
Yeah, they did what they were accusing other people falsely of doing, which is getting into the machinery of the voting machines and trying to look at the code and see how it works to access the machinery of actually, you know, counting the votes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly what you don't want to have happen. Well, that seems hypocritical to me.
Right. So it's similar to that case in Colorado where there's a county clerk who did a similar thing.
Yeah. Now, the migrant issue, which is the big thing now, I just had a story here about the sheriff of Bexar County, Texas, opening a criminal investigation that some of the migrants were promised something. I'm curious how Rick Scott justifies chartering private jets to fly migrants to Martha's Vineyard. Are Florida taxpayers cool with this?
So there's been some reporting with this. Governor DeSantis in Florida made this big show of doing this. I think, you know, Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who actually has, you know, a land border on the side of his state, started this first, sending migrants that came into Texas to Washington, D.C., to New York, to Chicago. And then DeSantis, who's, you know, obviously angling for a presidential run in 2024, got in on the act. Basically, it sounds like luring people, fooling people who were migrants in Texas with promises that they were going someplace where they'd be taken care of and they'd have all the opportunities, getting them on the plane and then dumping them in Martha's Vineyard, which is a lovely place, but, you know, was not expecting these folks and not exactly a place with a lot of low-cost housing and, you know, spots for immigrants. And there's been some questions raised about whether DeSantis had the budgetary authority to spend state money on basically a political stunt.
And how did this work? I mean, he's the governor of Florida, but these migrants were flown from Texas.
Yeah, apparently he sent a plane to Texas and sent people. There's somebody who just posted a brochure that these migrants were given. The interviews with the migrants, they said somebody told them in Spanish, mm-hmm. Hey, you got to come to this place called Massachusetts. I can give you a ride. There's a great opportunity there. And these are people who'd come from Venezuela. You know, they had walked from Venezuela in many cases. Yeah. They had suffered a great deal, and they took this person at their word, got on the plane, and then they take them to Martha's Vineyard and just leave them there. You know, basically, it's a stunt to make liberals say, well, you love immigration so much, why don't you deal with the immigrants? We are. But, you know, obviously, there's real people at the middle of this who are being used as a prop and basically dumped like garbage to make a point to, you know, DeSantis' political rivals.
It just seems like a missed opportunity because because DeSantis' whole thing is that we are now under, Biden's socialism. And here are refugees who are fleeing Venezuelan socialism, which is, or I think some would say communism. It seems to me that they would be DeSantis' allies, if anything.
And I mean, I don't know if this will matter in the upcoming governor's election in Florida, but Venezuelans are a huge voting bloc in Florida. There's a lot of Venezuelans in Florida, many of whom escaped the same left-wing dictatorship, you know, Chavez and Maduro.
Yeah.
And for DeSantis to say that we're going to use the people who've suffered, like these Venezuelans know the folks have suffered, you know, kind of as a plaything, it may not play well. I don't know if it'll affect his reelection or not, but I can't imagine it helps.
I also noticed, as long as we're talking about Rick Scott, he issued a 12-point plan, which included the Congress would have to vote every 5 years to renew social programs, including Social Security, so that conceivably Social Security, depending on who gets elected to Congress, could just be allowed to expire. So is he serious about this?
I couldn't believe that. Just because, you know, Republicans are trying to win an election that seems like it seems like they had it in the bag. Now it would be drifting away from them. What did we learn from the George Bush era? There's no political upside in saying you're going to touch Social Security or threaten Social Security. It's one of the most popular things the government does. It affects people who vote very reliably. So to say that you're going to put, you know, like dangle Social Security off a cliff every 5 years, I don't know who that appeals to. I don't know. It seems like political malpractice to me.
I guess we'll find out. David Farenthold, right. Live from the New York Times. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.